My name is Tom Scott. I'm chairman of the Nantucket Project. RP, if it's okay, I got another letter from Zach Light, the doctor at Columbia, which is an update. And I'm just going to read an excerpt of the letter. This is from Zach Light. I spent more time in the ICU today. One patient of the eight in my pod died during rounds this morning. His body was still in the room with other patients when we made rounds in the afternoon. He was in a bag. The other patients were sedated on ventilators. The non-ICU docs like me who are learning the ICU ropes feel overwhelmed by the responsibility and change in role. And as surgeons, we're not used to 4 hours of rounds on eight patients every morning. One of my colleagues, a hardcore acute care surgeon who really seemed to figure out the ICU thing the right way, told me that she thinks it's not possible to run an ICU pod for more than 3 days in a row. I spent a lot of time at a branch of the Hospital of Columbia called the Allen Hospital at the extreme northern tip of Manhattan, a 5-minute walk over a bridge from the Bronx. I helped the residents of the Allen SWAT team yesterday, which entailed spending quite a lot of time in the ER. The ER at the Allen was chaos. It was not designed for patients on ventilators. There were many patients there on ventilators. It is not designed for patients who need to be isolated. So patients on ventilators with COVID lay in, quote, bubbles with clear plastic wrap over their upper bodies, face, and heads. This made it impossible to get access to their necks for typical SWAT duty. Replacing lines in the necks is SWAT work. So we had to resort to placing lines in their groins instead. I helped a junior resident set up for a groin line with a woman, a very old woman, lying alone in a bay under plastic on a ventilator. She seemed awfully cold. I wondered whether she was living. She was not. So that's the scene out there. And as you can see, the crisis is at hand. I mean, it is underway. So it's pretty intense. It's pretty intense. And I assume you're hearing sort of similar things.
Yeah, that's a pretty poignant way to tell the story. But it's.
So RP, we get a lot of feedback on these things, and today I have a group of questions that people specifically called out. So we're going to go through a variety of them and try to get, you know, concise answers or the best answers you can give as a way to be useful. Good by you?
Yeah, I'll try to be as tight as I can too.
Okay. So first one is, a lot of us sadly are going to get sick, but let's say someone has mild symptoms. What should they do before we opt for before we consider which medical route to take?
Okay, so obviously not a doctor. Check out the CDC and WHO websites and other professional sources before you listen to me. Here's my thought. One, don't believe the shit everyone's emailing around about. I saw something yesterday about if you put this certain soap in your nose, or if you drink vodka and take a sauna, or this or this or this. Not true. This is a virus that gets deep into your lungs. Once it gets in you, you're not going to stop it on your own. Part one. Part two, so don't believe a lot of the hooey going around on the emails about like home cures and remedies. This has to be either you're going to be able to ride it out because you'll have low symptoms. It'll appear like a bad flu, and in some instances a really, really bad flu, or you're going to have to go to the hospital. Also, don't make the mistake of waiting too long. If you start having any trouble breathing, you need to get to a hospital right away. I think there's every reason to get in touch with your healthcare provider early if you think you have symptoms. They have protocols already set up. You're not going to unintentionally infect a doctor or an office. You don't have to worry about that. They know what they're doing. So call your doctor, call your hospital, tell them what your symptoms are. They know how to triage it better and better every time. They'll make sure you get to the right treatment you need. Don't believe the silliness on the internet about home cures. Don't worry about infecting your doctor or hospital. If you have any trouble breathing, you got to get there fast.
Okay. So we've heard a lot of competing information about masks. And we're talking about the citizens out here. What do you recommend for regular people to do? And what should the government be telling us to do vis-a-vis masks?
So this is a shitty admission. There's been a bit of a deception going on to the American public about masks from the medical elite. They've been telling us over and over, like, you don't need masks, they don't protect you. Well, then why do doctors wear masks? Obviously, they can protect you. yes, there's some truth to if you have a mask on improperly, it could become a problem because it gives you a false sense of security, or you would be touching your face a lot as you're adjusting the mask. But that can be handled, and that can be less of a cost and the benefit of wearing a mask. Wearing a mask does two things, actually. Most particularly, it prevents you from spreading your sputum into the air. Secondly, it prevents you from getting stuff in your mask. Third, it can prevent you from touching your face. So masks are actually a better thing if people have spent 5 minutes thinking about how to use them, right? And the five, we just discussed what those rules are. The problem, Tom, as we well know, and we were talking to Shoshana yesterday and your friend right now, you're just reading, I bet he could tell you, we don't have enough masks for the people who really, really, really need them, who are the doctors. So if we all end up with 10 N95 masks, that's millions and millions of masks that doctors don't have that they need. That's why the medical elite have been doing this fairly low-grade deception to America, saying, don't worry, you don't need masks. Of course we could use masks. Of course they help. I'm going to show you a graph right now. This is a graph of, this is a, first of all, a really powerful way of looking at the pandemic. It's a little complicated to know what we're looking at here. So let me describe quickly. First, it's a logarithmic scale on the left. So the vertical axis is a logarithmic scale, meaning it's going up by a factor of 10 every major tick. On the bottom, and that's the new confirmed cases in the past week on the left. On the bottom is the total number of confirmed cases. And this again, and this is done in logarithmic scale. So when you look at a graph like this and you see the countries that are dropping off the list, South Korea, China, Japan, that means that they are handling this in a much better way. And as you can see from the graph here, South Korea, Japan, and China are using masks on as many people who can wear them, plus massive testing, plus enforced quarantine. In America, alternatively, you see in the top there, we're not using masks for everybody who can get them. And there's a reason, I just described it. Nor are we doing enforced quarantine. We're doing suggested social distancing, which is just not quite as strong a fix. But if you look at this graph, part of the reason South Korea, China, and Japan have had such a comparatively resounding success dealing with this compared to us is masks and stricter enforcement of quarantine. So masks work. Now, the good news is you really can make your own mask. Trump yesterday in the press conference even started talking about this. You can see the doctors getting a little uncomfortable as he was saying it. Go to the CDC website. They talk about how you can make your own mask. So I think we need to start realizing, make your own mask. You got stuff in your work shed right there, Tom, that could probably do it. Cut up the jacket you have on, put it over your face. But we need to start realizing wearing a mask is actually a responsible thing to do. So I think we need to start thinking about doing that. Absolutely, positively not at the cost of doctors having masks.
And within that, if I found five masks in my house, should I drive them to the hospital and say, here you go, guys?
If they're N95 masks, those are rare. Those are rare and valuable and necessary. I don't think you should drive to the hospital. I don't think they need another person showing up. I think you should try to call the hospital. There is an organization. I will send you a link. We can put it up on the website. That's collecting PPE for New York doctors. Dr. Quadracci in New York City has helped put this together. And I will get the link for you and you can throw it up, Tom. So there are organizations that can help collect this stuff. You should not get in your car and drive to the hospital.
Okay. What can you tell us about asymptomatic patients and the numbers related to they being the spreaders or the role they play in spreading?
This disease, a large number of people are what's called asymptomatic. They don't, or they're very low symptomatic. In the beginning, we thought people literally had this and had no symptoms. That's probably not true. They do have some symptoms, runny nose, sniffles, slightly increased temperature for a little while. We don't think right now the data does not show that there's truly asymptomatic people, but there's a lot of people who I woke up with sniffles today, certainly not from corona because I've been locked away, but you know, that would be an example of low symptom. So if you're a low symptom person, you can still be virally shedding. You can still be spreading the disease. And that's probably a big reason this has spread so rapidly. So think about Ebola, right? Ebola is a different disease, thank God. Ebola, you literally melt from within. You bleed from your eyeballs and your mouth and your nose. You're pretty clearly infected when you got Ebola. So I can see, oh my God, that person has Ebola. I can stay away. they can't even move because they're dying so rapidly. Those diseases spread less rapidly because, you know, as I described, this one, you can be walking around and you can be lowly symptomatic and spread the disease. And that's generally going to be younger people. It appears that this disease has less symptomology in younger people.
We hear a lot about pre-existing medical conditions and that they be more vulnerable. Can you classify what those are?
Yeah. So first, let's talk about this. Do you know this response we all have when you get a phone call from someone and they say, "Oh my God, Sally died," or "Oh my God, Sam died"? The first thing everybody wants to ask is how they die, and you particularly want to know if they're your age, your cohort. You know, like, I'm not supposed to die right now. My brain is pretty sure of that. And if you call up and say, "Hey, you know our pal who's like a lot like you, he just died. Oh my God, how'd he die?" And if you say he died paragliding or parachuting or scuba diving, I'm like, "Hey, no problem. Not going to happen to me." If you say he died from corona, I'm going to say, "Did he have cardiovascular disease? Did he have diabetes? Did he have chronic respiratory distress?" And you might say yes. And again, I can pull myself back from it, not panic, right? So the reason I mention this is everyone's getting really, we are trying to find, our brain is looking for defense mechanisms to say, "Won't happen to me, won't happen to me." And a lot of it is this comorbidity, pre-existing disease question. So A, yes, there are, these things exist. There is a reality that if you have a pre-existing condition, your death rate increases dramatically with this disease. They are cardiovascular disease, diabetes. Unfortunately, this is really, really vicious to people with diabetes. Chronic respiratory disease, hypertension, cancer. Those are the big five right now. The death rates go up, you know, five times, right? So cardiovascular disease, the confirmed death rate is 13.2%. Diabetes, 9.2% for all cases. Hypertension, 8.4, high blood pressure. So it really matters. Obesity is another one. You know, your friend in the letter you're reading was talking about putting lines in people. Another challenge is if you're obese, it's hard to get the line in. If you have pre-existing lung damage, if you have asthma, this is something you have to be very, very careful about. So it increases the death rate dramatically, yes.
Tell us your view on the warmer weather slowing the virus.
There was a study out of University of Maryland about 2 weeks ago, seemingly very well done, and it talked about these danger latitudes, right? So if you looked at the initial outbreak of the disease from Wuhan to New York to Lombardy, Italy, if you can picture on a globe, those are all at, I forgot what it was, 51 degree. It's all about the similar latitude, right, around the Earth. And so, you know, you could look at that. This is a causation versus correlation error. You could look at that and say, "Oh, look, they're all in this sort of northern band." And the answer is, well, no, they're actually not. And then you would correlate to, "Oh, so it's because it's colder." And we all do have this sort of sense memory that flu goes away in the summer, right? So this, you know, seemingly smart study said, "Don't worry, it's going to die off in warmer weather." Well, not true. Right? So Singapore in the summer had a surge. Australia in the summer had a surge. Other places that were in their warm periods, the Southern Hemisphere, were having a surge of the disease as well. So no, it unfortunately didn't correlate to weather as much as we'd like to believe. But it is true that the simple physics of transmitting the microparticulate matter, the spittle from your mouth, changes in warmer, drier temperatures, or wetter temperatures. So the molecular, your spit sinks faster, right? So you and I talking in a wet, hot summer, that's going to sink faster than in a dry, cold winter. So we do have a longer transmission radius in this current weather. It is also true that increased ultraviolet light does degrade the virus to some extent. I sincerely hope we'll see a decrease in transmission in the summer. It probably will be, but it's not going to be the end all of this problem.
How do citizens, is it helpful to be pressuring government? I know this is a subjective question, but how can citizens, you know, effectively encourage the government in a helpful way?
By the people, for the people. By the people, for the people. This is our government. This is your government. That is your mayor. That is your congressperson, senator, and president. It's not pressuring the government. It's doing your civic duty to ensure they understand your point of view. you know, we have our chance to vote. We also have our chance in the middle of a voting cycle to pressure the government to make our voices heard. You know, there's this soap opera going on about the president and the governors, which he's very eager to be part of. It's completely non-productive. And if you're a governor right now, you know, they have to make this decision about how much are they going to poke at the president and advocate for their state, let's put it that way, and then risk him cutting down their supplies, which unfortunately has happened. It's kind of absurd, but, you know, Texas, which has been very supportive of the president, appears to have gotten more of the aid they wanted versus Cuomo and other states where it's becoming a political pissing match. So that's that. Now that's the White House. At the mayor level, at your CEO level, like your boss, and at your governor level, absolutely get on their case. And if they're not shutting down now, whatever your view is, my view happens to be mask, social distancing, you know, enforced quarantine is going to get us out of this cheaper, faster, better. Like, this is the better way out. Go tell your local officials as best you can. But at the same time, I never buy this idea of like, don't criticize your government while we're at war, because that's an implicit criticism of the soldiers. You remember this whole argument? Like, how dare you criticize the president about the war? You're not standing behind the fighting people. Like, wrong. I'm talking about a policy position. So don't buy this idea that you can't go criticize a leader because that means you're not supporting the frontline doctors and medical workers. Ridiculous. Do all you can to support them, but make your voices heard. But look, more critically, Tom, we talked about this yesterday. This is it, man. Like, don't sit back and expect anyone to swoop in and save you, right? Like, the federal government's not doing what they need to do right now. Okay, fine. You can do it. I hope to God you can do it. You know, everyone here has the capacity, ideally, not everyone does. Everyone here, if you have the privilege to be able, if you're affluent enough to be able to social distance and protect yourself, do it. Be part of the solution. If you don't, figure out inside that workplace what you can do to be the most safe. Tell your boss, you need to have safe working conditions. Sloan Valve, I talk about them all the time. They run a factory in Chicago right now. There's people working on a factory floor, and they have brilliant situations in place where people are being physically distanced from each other so they can make their critical products for the world. Every factory should be doing that. Every boss should be ensuring you're not sitting on each other's laps. You have 6 feet of distancing. You have hand sanitizer around. You're washing your hands regularly. You're working from home if you can. And you should go scream and yell to your boss, your mayor, your governor, if they're not doing that.
RP, what do you see? I don't know if this is the right term, but as we reopen culturally, go back to normal life, what does that look like?
I was just talking to a mutual friend of ours today, Tom, about like what's happening to us psychologically in this process. And you remember in the first conversation we had, we talked about the duality of this reality. One reality is under pressure, humans revert to type, right? Under attack, we go into our cave, we get our pointy sticks, and no one's allowed in. So we're all literally doing that right now. Someone walks to your door, even the UPS guy is putting his life at risk, and you're like, oh God, who's this invader, right? That's a very, very deep, visceral, limbic, genetic part of who we are. And we're doing this for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Are we going to be able to turn that off as soon as this is over? Are we going to be able to, you know, change our limbic response to strangers and other people? I hope so. On the other hand, this is this opportunity to find the best in us and to find the best cooperation and some sense of, I mean, thank God for the internet right now. As one of your guests said a few days ago, if we didn't have the internet, the ability to communicate, the ability to create this hive mind where we're trying to solve things together, we'd be in a really worse situation. And that's creating, in many instances, renewed bonds. But you know what would be important is that those bonds aren't just of type, right? I think it'd be really valuable if we were looking across gender, across race, across socioeconomic class, across sexual identification in these conversations and had as broad a conversation as possible so that we realize that we could expand that circle of empathy. So those are the two choices that we're making. And at the end of this, you know, let's hope we have that broader circle of empathy and we kind of all got through this together. We have a renewed sense of community, a renewed sense of neighborhood, Tom, you know, your big initiative, which is so important. And let's figure out how we can drive that forward. And people like you are going to be necessary to do that. And let's remember when we kind of get out of our caves that we don't have to be looking at everybody like they're trying to infect us, nor should we look at them like that right now. But that naturally is part of what's happening in our brains.
Incidentally, we are planning neighborhood town halls over the next few days in geographically specific places. We'll tell you more about that when that's coming. I see a lot on social media. People want to know why don't we have mandatory lockdowns in place? What is that about?
Very simple. The federal government, the president has gone through a series of conversations where he's balancing keeping the economy alive or keeping human beings alive. And it is not an easy decision. This is not an example of where his decision-making process is horrid. It's a real question. If you shut down, if you take away jobs, if you take away particularly the ability to earn, you begin to enhance deaths of despair, right? Suicide, opiates, you begin to have people just locked in their rooms playing video games, etc. And I mean, just put clearly, like, money's got to flow for people to have the lives we're expecting to have right now. Now, if people are dead, they can't have those lives anyway, right? So the president has tried to figure this out. He clearly is concerned about his reelection. He's clearly concerned about, you know, the timing is bad in that instance. If it was earlier in administration, perhaps there'd be less political thinking going on here. And so he has not made the hard decision that many, many other nations have made. Australia, Canada, Switzerland, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, India, Japan, South Korea, China, other countries have said, hey, you know what the best move is here? Take our lumps, take our medicine all at once, lock it down. I was talking to someone today in Australia. In Australia, they have a home quarantine going on. The government's called this family repeatedly throughout the week. Want to make sure you're home, want to make sure you're home. Talk to another person in Singapore today. The government has cameras outside the home of people who are self-quarantining to make sure they're staying there. Like, that's enforcement. And if you do that, this thing goes away, right? Take your medicine up front and you will, you'll get over this. Instead, we've kicked the can down the road, kicked the can down the road, kicked the can down the road. And the virus is caught up, spread. This is a highly contagious virus that spreads asymptomatically, right? It just spreads much faster and much hardier than most other diseases we're familiar with. And it's ripped through the population. And so now we're just going to have to reap the wind of this for a while as the curve goes up and we'll come down. So that's why we haven't made a federal decision to do it. Some governors have made more strident decisions, what I would say are more proper decisions to lock down. Rhode Island has been pretty strict on the lockdown. Connecticut, Governor Lamont was quite smart and strict on his lockdown. And other states have laughed at it, and they're going to, unfortunately, their citizens are going to pay the price. So it's just a political decision. But remember, you, if you're privileged enough to be able to make the decision yourself, make it. If you're a CEO, make it. If you're a mayor, make it. If you're a governor, make it.
I'm curious, when you think about the when we look forward on sort of the economic piece here, you know, we're now through the third stimulus. You were saying a fourth stimulus is likely to come, let's say, in the next 30 days. Do you see some kind of a grand bargain that perhaps there's like debt forgiveness on a grand scale, or is there something grand that will be required to kickstart the economy when it comes time to kick it back into place again?
So, like, the really, really bad news is we've never faced just an economic freeze, right? Which is kind of what we have now. Remember, GDP is the amount of capital, the velocity of capital. The money's got to move. So big stacks of money don't help if they're not moving from person to person to person to person. Right now, money is not moving. We don't know what to do with this. We've never seen it before. This is not the 2008-2009 banking crisis. And so this is different. Now, the good news is what we learned from the years after the 08-09 economic crisis, although there was so much criticism of it, what we've learned is the government, the U.S. government, can effectively print money with no circumstance. Just print money, dump money, print money, dump money. It's not going to lead to inflationary or deflationary death spirals. That's at least what we've learned in the last, you know, what is that, 12 years. We can actually do fine. It's against all sorts of economic theory, but just look at the practice. It's worked, right? So the phase three bill was not so bad, considering, you know, 600 legislators had to get together and build that thing, and they did it. And I think it was relatively good. Phase four needs to be better. Grand bargain, Tom. I just think there's an awfully simple way to do this. And I think we may have missed the boat because we spent so much money on the checks to every American, $1,200 to lots of Americans. Like, I guess that's something, but it's really not the structural fix we need. The structural fix we need is just simple enough. I would have said, you know, every employer, every company with an EIN who employs a person, be it the Nantucket Project or Boeing or Apple, send the government a bill for your revenue for, what is it, 2 months, 3 months, whatever the period of time is, and we're going to pay the bill. That's it. You, in turn, are not going to lay anybody off, or there's a series of rules you're going to follow. No stock buybacks, no layoffs, et cetera. That would be solving for the cement of balance sheets in some ways, right? So, but I think we missed the boat on that because we've already spent so much money on these checks. Thank God we're America. Thank God of our economic strength. Thank God the lessons we learned. Thank God there's no moral hazard here, this concept of moral hazard. Remember at the end of 08-09, a lot of banks were bailed out. And people said, why in the world are you bailing out this bank? They've been internally corrupt, rotting from the inside. They made really, really bad bets on the non-performing loans. Why would you bail them out, right? The business has to have a Darwinian process to work. You're bailing out non-performers, and they poorly performed on their own fault. That's called moral hazard. There's no moral hazard here. There's no business that blew it. There's no business that got this wrong. We all just got every person, every company got banged on the head by a sledgehammer at the same time. You know, you're not creating perverse incentives by fixing this, and we have the dough to do it. You know, let's see what happens. But unfortunately, we spent so much money already, Tom, that we may have missed the chance for a grand bargain. But I think phase four ideally is going to be a little more targeted, a little more specific, and they got to worry about small businesses. But we're not up there lobbying like the big businesses are. There's this whole question about debt. You know, a lot of money that's been paid now is grade A debt. There's no debt in my world. Small businesses don't have debt, certainly that trades, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I have to say, there's this little thing in the back of my head that wonders, our federal debt, it has seemingly, since I was conscious of elections, they've been talking about it, let's say somewhere around the entry of Jimmy Carter on the scene. And for some reason, it's just ballooned in every ensuing year in my life to where we are today. And in the back of my mind, I always thought, well, it's okay until the big crisis. And during the big crisis, you just don't know what's gonna happen. Well, that's a tiny fear in there for me, that there's a combination of...
Do you mean individual debt or government debt?
I'm talking government, sorry. I'm talking about the big debt, the big trillions that are being spent right now. Makes me anxious. And it makes me anxious purely on a common sense level. I don't know, you know, the curves as well as you and say others may, but to me, it's just a common sense thing of... debt has its issues, and it, I would imagine during crisis is when those issues become the greatest, but a thought.
Let's not do an economic discussion here, but let me just do two sentences on that. Families should balance their checkbooks. Families shouldn't use high interest credit cards. Like, we all know that it's true. Governments do not have to follow the same rules. We kind of know that now too. When the United States gets debt, right now we're selling bonds, right? That's what debt means. We're selling bonds at, what is it, like 1%, like some tiny number, zero? I think it's zero now, right? The Fed funds rate's zero. So we are saying to the world, hey, give us money and we'll give you 0% interest in 10 years. And the world's giving us money. Sounds good to me. It's not the same as that MasterCard you're paying 20% debt on, right? 20% interest on. So that debt's not, that doesn't bother me. Deficit spending is a little different. Debt is how you fund deficit spending. But look, if there ever was a time for extraordinary fiscal measures, you're looking at it, right? This is it. This is the time when you do these crazy things. And by the way, remember 08, 09, people were crazy. They, oh my God, I had brilliant friends saying, we have to buy gold. We have to go buy Swiss currencies. The Fed's going to destroy America. No, America came out faster, stronger than any economy in the world because of stimulus. Yeah. So in this instance, I'm all for stimulus.
All right, RP, the next question is, what does RP stand for?
It's ironic. You know, my parents were kind of prescient. It stands for respiratory protection. So it's about masks and no, it stands for Randolph Post. Yep, Randolph Post.
And do you get that question a lot?
I do. It's which is better than what does JP stand for? You know, like as long as they hear my name, it's and our son is also Randolph Post. So it's quite a handle, and that's why RP is perhaps the easiest way to deal with it.
Okay, RP, thank you. This is what people wanted to know. I think we did a nice job getting it out there. And as a reminder, this is now available on podcasts. Go to the Nantucket Project at the Apple Store if you'd like it. And we're going to cut a short version each day and the full version each day. You can do it in video and you can do it in podcast. So
thank you so much, Tom. I really enjoy getting to do this. I appreciate all the effort you and the team are putting into this.
And you as well. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Be safe.